Chapter 11, Patterns of Progress. Walter Hines Page missed his North Carolina turnips so much that he had them shipped all the way to London. Page had grown up in Moore County and gone on to become an influential journalist, first in Raleigh, then in New York City. He gained fame for his plain speaking about living subjects and hearty living. After 1913, he was the U.S. ambassador to Great Britain. He served his country in an important way during a very dangerous time, World War I. Page greatly influenced the policies of another former North Carolina resident, President Woodrow Wilson. The president had grown up in Wilmington and gone to Davidson College before moving north. Page convinced Wilson that the United States needed to help the British fight the Germans to make the world safe for democracy. When the United States entered the World War in 1917, it started down the road to world dominance during the 20th century. North Carolinians helped push the nation in that direction and continued to serve it afterward. Americans like Page and Wilson were known as progressives. In North Carolina, progressives often referred to the spirit of progress being at the heart of their efforts to reform the state. For them, progress was really just another word for industrial development. They believed progress would help people better their lives. If a state could organize its raw materials and human resources in factories and turn out manufactured products cheap enough for anyone to buy, it would create a wealthy society that would benefit everyone. Page, a founder of North Carolina State College, had argued for years that North Carolina was controlled by mummies, leaders so wrapped up in the agrarian past that they would not face the new industrial future. Progress had human costs in North Carolina. The whole state, in a way, became one big factory where some people handled the raw materials, others the finished goods. Life in North Carolina became more socially rigid. People were defined by their economic and social status, and it was unusual for a person to move outside his or her class or social group. Everyone was expected to develop new habits that would help achieve progress. In the end, progress meant that citizens with white skin benefited more than did those whose skin color was not white. Segregation in the early 1900s went hand in hand with progress. Section 1. Progress, Democrats, and Education. As you read, look for steps that led to the disfranchisement of African Americans and segregation in the state. Efforts to improve education in North Carolina. Legislation to bring progress to the state, and the following terms: hydroelectricity, disfranchisement, grandfather clause, universal education, equalization, referendum, prohibition, compulsory education, and Jim Crow laws. North Carolina's economy grew rapidly once the troubles of the 1890s were resolved. By the early years of the 20th century, North Carolina had become the leading manufacturing state in the South. The growth of local industry rivaled that of some northern states. North Carolina was able to expand its wealth, in part, because it finally took advantage of its rock-filled western rivers. Industrial progress. James B. Duke moved to Charlotte and started a new industry. After 1904, he built dams across the Catawba River to generate electricity. Duke originally sold the power to nearby textile mills. Duke's first big customer was James W. Cannon, who built a new town, Cannapolis, in 1906 to take advantage of the situation. Eventually, the entire North Carolina Piedmont benefited from the hydroelectricity, water-powered electricity, made by what became the Duke Power Company. Most of North Carolina's industrial growth was concentrated in tobacco, textiles, and furniture. Because of the Duke family, Durham became the source for most of the nation's cigarettes. After 1913, under the leadership of R.J. Reynolds, Winston-Salem began to rival it. Gaston County became the center of the textile industry, with almost 100 mills by the 1920s. North Carolinians like the Haynes brothers in Winston-Salem also built knitting mills that made socks and underwear. High Point had 33 furniture plants in 1900, more than 100 by 1913. Towns continued to grow rapidly. More than a dozen towns had at least 10,000 people living nearby in 1910. Gastonia, for example, seemed to build a cotton mill and grow by 1,000 people each year. It erected three factories in 1902, started a library in 1904, paved its first streets in 1907, and built a hospital in 1908. Towns became the centers of progress, and each town claimed it was more progressive than any other. In 1902, leaders of Durham urged their citizens to eat Durham, sleep Durham, wear Durham, and smoke Durham. To handle industrial growth, the state had to be more organized. That meant that people had to be educated in new ways and influenced to behave in new ways. White leaders used politics to accomplish these goals. Disfranchisement and the election of 1900. The white supremacists, who took over the state legislature in 1898, moved quickly to reorganize North Carolina. They wanted to develop the state's industrial potential by assigning everyone a particular role in manufacturing. In 1900, these Democrats proposed two ideas that would impact every citizen in the state. Behind both ideas was the principle of segregation, the white-based belief that both races would be better off if they were kept separate, with blacks assigned the task of serving whites. The first proposal called for all voters to be literate because reading and writing were needed for advancement in the new industrial environment. It was evident to everyone that the Democrats had a racial motive in promoting literacy. A majority of black men were illiterate, compared to one-fifth of white men. If literacy were made a requirement for voting, most black men would suffer disfranchisement. That is, they would lose the right to vote given them during Reconstruction. Because many white men had not had much schooling, the proposal would disfranchise them as well. To handle that problem, the Democrats took advantage of the racial prejudice of the day, where many whites were convinced that blacks had been given too many privileges because of Reconstruction. The Democrats proposed a grandfather clause that provided exceptions to the literacy rule. The plan said that any man whose father or grandfather, hence the name, had voted before 1867 could vote anyway because that family had always done so. This meant that very few freedmen families could qualify since 1867 was the first year blacks had voted in the state. The real idea was to eliminate the black vote that had twice, in 1868 and again in 1894, allowed the Republicans to take over state government. The second proposal promised that the state would move forward to create a public education system that would respond to the new demands of industry. Charles B. Aycock of Goldsboro, who was the Democratic candidate for governor in 1900, personally championed the idea of universal education. Every child, white and black, was to have access to better schools. In fact, the state legislature was to provide these opportunities through equalization, funding schools in poorer counties at a greater rate than in richer counties. That way, Aycock argued across the state, every young person could begin to gain the skills needed for the new jobs of the day. Aycock made it clear to everyone that the new schools would be segregated, but he personally pushed for the growth of black schools. Not all North Carolinians agreed with the Democratic plan. Whites in the mountains, who were more likely to be illiterate, did not trust that the grandfather clause would be followed. A riot broke out in Maiden, a mill village in Catawba County, over the issue. Blacks, led by George H. White, the last remaining African-American congressman, protested vigorously. However, irregularities kept many of them from having their votes counted. In the end, Democrats won the election, and the disfranchisement amendment to the state constitution was passed. North Carolinians who approved of the transitions going on around them elected Aycock. He received most of his support in two key places. First, on the coastal plain where black sharecroppers grew tobacco and cotton, and second, in the Piedmont mill villages where white farmers had gone to work in the factories. Whites on the coastal plain correctly saw that disfranchisement would make it easier to control the black sharecroppers because the Republican Party would have no reason to continue to help them. Millhands also understood how disfranchisement would keep blacks from competing with them for jobs. The Aycock Education Plan. Disfranchisement immediately eliminated most of the black vote from state politics and turned the Republican Party into a minority. Although white voters in the West continued to vote Republican, Democrats could assume that statewide they would control the state legislature in each election. Republicans helped them achieve this by abandoning the black vote and becoming lily white. Governor Aycock and his allies then put forward a progressive agenda of laws that would sort out North Carolinians for industrial work. Every state resident would be put in place for the new economy sweeping the state. Aycock asked both the legislature and the counties to spend more money on graded education. The legislature soon established several normal colleges designed to train teachers for the new graded schools. The white teacher colleges became known as Appalachian, East Carolina, and Western Carolina. Black teacher colleges were located in Elizabeth City and Fayetteville. In addition, the university at Chapel Hill was better funded to train professors to go to the normal schools and teach teachers how to teach. The legislation also adopted Governor Aycock's equalization plan. Aycock crisscrossed the state urging counties to provide supplemental taxes for new schools. Between 1902 and 1914, thousands of Aycock schools were built across the state. For the first time, many rural areas could afford graded schools. Each was built as a partnership between the state and the neighborhoods the schools served. Often, the frame structures replaced decaying log cabins that had been used since the Civil War. By the 1910s, many rural counties set up high schools, which allowed farm families to have their children move forward in grade without going the longer distance into nearby towns. History by the Highway. John Motley Moorhead III. The Moorhead family of Greensboro operated an unsuccessful aluminum plant at the town of Spray, now the city of Eden in Rockingham County, in the 1890s. While experimenting with a new way to make aluminum, company researchers accidentally discovered the compound calcium carbide. When mixed with water, this compound gave off acetylene gas, which was later used in welding torches. The first commercial calcium carbide plant was built in this area by James Turner Moorhead in 1894. John Motley Moorhead III, James's son, was instrumental in establishing the Union Carbide Corporation in New York. Moorhead III, who was the grandson of Governor John Motley Moorhead, later used the fortune he made to set up the Moorhead Scholarship Program, now the Moorhead Kane Scholarship Program, at the University of North Carolina. Section 1 continued. Legislating Behavior. The Democratic legislatures of the early 1900s passed a series of laws that altered the traditional behavior of North Carolinians. Alcohol, child labor, and race were all important issues of the day. Before 1900, most state citizens could drink at bars and distilleries, places where alcoholic beverages are made. Some towns, Concord being the first in 1887, had banned bars, but most communities still had them. Many manufacturers, however, argued that drinking was not compatible with work in the new factories. Drunken workers would be hurt in the machines, and drinkers were more likely to miss work. In 1908, the legislature sponsored a referendum, a vote of the people on a particular issue. A majority of voters, almost all white by this time, approved prohibition, which made it illegal to make, possess, or consume alcoholic beverages. The migration to the mill villages often resulted in young children being put to work in the factory. Those rural children had worked on the family farm, so working in a factory seemed like a somewhat normal progression. The Odell Cotton Mill in Concord, for example, had 110 preteens working in 1900. In 1903, the state passed a child labor law, which forbade parents from putting children under the age of 12 in the mills. Most of the mills ignored the law if families agreed to allow their children to work. In 1913, the legislature approved compulsory education, which required every child to attend school until a specific age unless there was a family situation that required the child to work. These laws again resulted in a change from tradition. The state, not the family, made these decisions. Race was always an issue. The legislature supported segregation laws that separated the races, particularly in public places like city parks and graded schools. These rules became known as Jim Crow laws, after an old minstrel show that made blacks look foolish and dependent. The laws even said that any citizen whose great-grandparent had been black was also black and therefore subject to the restrictions that went with segregation. After 1906, that meant that a black person, when called to the witness stand in a courtroom, had to swear on a separate Bible than the one whites used. It meant that in the new railroad station in Charlotte, blacks and whites went to different ticket booths and different waiting rooms. By 1910, North Carolina had become a strictly segregated society, the whole idea supported as part of the progressive advancement of the state. No one was allowed to challenge the new system. In Durham, a Trinity College professor was almost fired for even hinting that blacks could be as good as whites. In 1903, John S. Bassett wrote that Booker T. Washington, the nation's most famous African-American educator, was the greatest man, save General Robert E. Lee, born in the South in the last 100 years. Whites across the state called for his dismissal. Only the influence of the Dukes kept him around. Special feature, Carolina people, the Wright brothers. North Carolina has for years put first in flight on its automobile license plates. The state has good reason to make this claim. As people around the world know, the first powered flight of what came to be called an airplane was at Kitty Hawk on the Outer Banks. The first flyers were not North Carolinians, however. The Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur, lived in Dayton, Ohio. Yet, they needed North Carolina's Outer Banks to make their dream come true, to prove that manned flight was possible and that people could stay in the air for long periods of time using the technology they had perfected. Because of their success, North Carolinians have ever since claimed them. The Wrights spent years figuring out a way for flight to occur. They watched others who tried different technologies but had little success. Their breakthrough came when they realized that imitating a bird would not work. Humans needed to push their way through the air like a boat pushes against the water. The Wrights designed their wings to use unequal air pressure to create lift, allowing an airplane to go up. The Wrights needed a place to test their ideas on gliders. They found the tall sand dunes near Killdevil Hill to be perfect for their needs. The winds were fairly steady through most of the year, and the landings would be softened by the sand. The Wrights made hundreds of test flights in their gliders. Finally, after many tests and adjustments, in the fall of 1903, the Wrights were ready to see if humans could direct a powered craft through the air. On the morning of December 17, 1903, Orville, lying prone, face down, on the plane, felt it lift into the air. It stayed airborne for 12 seconds. A half dozen Outer Banks residents witnessed the feat. On the fourth and last flight of the day, Wilbur stayed in the air for a gleeful half mile. After that, they had to stop when a sudden gust of wind caught the wings of the plane and twisted them like an umbrella in a storm. The damage was too hard to repair. The Wrights reported their achievement to the scientific world. Many of the innovations that would eventually take human beings all the way to the moon were first tested successfully at Kitty Hawk. As a tribute to the Wrights' accomplishments, astronaut Neil Armstrong, the first person to walk on the moon, carried a fragment of the 1903 Wright Flyer with him on his 1969 Apollo 11 mission to the moon. What some folks at nearby Nag's Head said was a fool attempt by harmless cranks turned out to be the most important thing North Carolina has ever contributed to human history. As one Outer Banks resident said later, the names Orville and Wilbur will endure forever. Since 1903, North Carolina has participated in worldwide celebrations of the feat in 1953 and 2003.